Hello and welcome to another very special episode of Bone Up the Podcast. Richie and I are still in France at the ECTS Congress in Marseille, and we're going to bring you another selection of interviews that we did with both senior and junior researchers and all sorts of interesting people here in France.
Listeners, we've got some great guests for you in this second episode. We spoke to some more ECTS Academy members. We spoke to the IFMRS about the work they're doing to bring all of the societies around bone research together. Big friend of the podcast, Cassia Vade, and some young prize winners from around the world. Enjoy.
So if you're interested to hear more about the latest research on your infrastructure of calcified collagen, this is Bone Up Live. So we're delighted to have another prize winner with us, Amy Oribe.
Yeah, very nice.
I got it. And we want to hear about your research. I know it's to do with osteoclasts, but you tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, so I've been working on a funny gene. It's called SLC37A2. So mm-hmm. A bit of a mouthful,
yeah.
But we're looking at what it's doing in osteoclast lysosomes and how just this tiny little thing on this osteoclast lysosome can actually regulate the function of the cell and then the thickness of bones.
Mm.
Yeah.
And we know that osteoclasts are the cells responsible for essentially removing bone.
Yeah.
And in most osteoporosis that I would see at the clinic, it's excessive bone loss is the problem,
yeah.
Particularly after the menopause. So you were looking at how that cell works and how it's regulated.
Yeah.
So tell us a little more. The lysosome you mentioned, what's yes. that in the cell?
Yeah, so lysosomes traditionally were seen as the trash can or the bin of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little pocket of membrane, and inside this membrane is a bunch of enzymes and a lot of acid.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it was seen as the bin is because cells just send whatever they don't want into there to get degraded. But what we've learned with more modern techniques in cell biology is that this little sack of enzymes is doing a lot more for the cell than we previously thought. And this is especially true for the osteoclast.
Mm. And you've been looking at a gene that controls it?
Yeah. So we've got this SLC37A2 that we've worked on is like a little gatekeeper mm-hmm. on this little sac on the membrane of the lysosome. And what it's doing, it's regulating the exit of sugars from this little bag. And I don't know if you remember your high school bio,
mm-hmm.
but the sugars are really important in osmotic pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this protein is on the surface and allowing these sugars to come out, the osmotic pressure changes all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than this little lysosome, this little sac of membrane being really inflated and having like a lot of tension in its membrane, just like a full balloon,
yeah.
It sort of softens, and that allows then for other proteins to come and then pull on it. And then we see what's happening in these cells is we see a little tubulated lysosome starts to form. So rather mm-hmm. than being a balloon that's like a round yeah. one, you get the
it
long ones.
The long sausage
yeah,
balloon.
Yeah.
And is there a difference in function between the balloon and the sausage?
Yeah, so in other cell types, it does, you know, different things. But in the osteoclast specifically, and now I need to sort of talk about the anatomy of the cell a little
yeah,
more.
That's what we're here for.
So what the osteoclast does, it kind of like sucks itself onto the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has to actually spit all these enzymes and acid onto the bone. And that's where the lysosome comes in. So in that region that's against the bone, these lysosomes come in and they fuse with the membrane of the cell to release all of this acid outside onto the bone. But what this creates is a lot of membrane all of a sudden that's all in one place, mm-hmm. and then we call this the ruffle border.
Yeah.
And it does look like ruffles. And you see this when you look at the cells in bone, actually, with some microscopy. And because this lysosome is now tubulated, what it can do is it can infiltrate deep into this set of
the
membrane
bone,
ruffles,
yeah.
and it can continue to deliver the acid and the enzyme really close to the bone rather than far away, you know, and it's way more efficient.
For the benefit of the tape, Richie and David are staring in wonderment at this.
Mm-hmm.
So I've heard about the ruffle border so much in the past when
yeah.
I learned about my cell biology, but I didn't really understand this complex mechanism that led to the formation of it and then
yeah.
the release of the acids and enzymes.
Yeah. It's really crucial for the osteoclast function.
So depending on whether you have a balloon or a sausage
yeah.
for the lysosome, does
yeah.
that change the way that the ruffled border forms or the way in which the acid and the enzymes are spat out?
Yeah, exactly. So when we've got this SLC on the lysosome, this little gatekeeper, we get this tubulation, and then the lysosomes that are all tubulated, like the sausage balloons, they can go deep into this, they can deliver all that they need, and then you get this really nice mature ruffle border, and then the bone gets resolved really well. But what we have in our knockout cells, so this is where the gate has been removed,
mm-hmm.
and there's no possibility for the balloon or the lysosome to go from a normal balloon shape into an elongated shape. And you can imagine that trying to get this big vacuole to come fuse this with this really delicate and ruffled membrane is going to be much harder. And also moving it through the cell is going to be harder rather than moving some, you know, very precise, thin little tubule.
Mm. So in terms of then, to come back to the clinic and osteoporosis, I suppose we sometimes imagine there's just more osteoclasts or they're working harder in osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that you could different qualities of osteoclasts. Some are really good at resorbing bone, some don't resorb bone. Just maybe I'm simplifying things a bit, but
yeah.
that's sort of where you're in that area, that the control of the lysosome might affect how well the osteoclast works to resorb bone, is that?
Yeah. So that's true to some point with osteoporosis, but it's even more true with the opposing disease.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another disease, and the technical term is sclerosing bone disorder
yeah.
or osteopetrosis.
Yeah.
But I kind of like the more friendly term of stone bone disease.
Stone bone, yeah, we hear,
yeah.
we've mentioned a few bone thickening diseases before,
yeah.
so.
Yeah, and this is really generally because of osteoclast lysosomes not working properly.
So now then, you think you may have a potential target?
Yeah, that's the hope, is that it can, you know, in 15 years' time become some new drug. We still have, you know, a lot of checks and balances to go through, but we think it may well be a powerful target, and even more so because in this mouse that we've taken the gene out, we've got reduced osteoclast activity, but we also have increased osteoblast activity. So it would actually, if, you know, it turns out, this would be a dream, but
yes, yeah.
if it turns out to be something that we can use in patients, we could prevent osteoclast function and resorption, and we can actually
increase osteoblasts.
So it would be like a dual action type of system.
That's very exciting.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it again. You heard it here first on the Bone Up podcast.
Thank you, Amy, for joining us today. That was absolutely fabulous. So well explained. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, it was really good fun. Thank you.
We're very excited to have our next guest, Jack De La Via. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And where did you come from, Jack? Where have you flown in from?
From Perth. So quite a journey. Glad
to
be here.
How long was your flight?
I spent about 27 hours, I think, in transit on the way. So
it's great. Even though this is the European Congress, it's great to see people from right across the world here all talking about bone. It's great.
And this gives us the opportunity to talk to you about your prize. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You won the clinical prize for the best paper. And that is a hard price to get. There's some good clinical research here.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Have you told your lab back home about it?
Yes, so a few of them are here, fortunately enough, so yeah.
Oh, fantastic. So would you tell us about the research then that you won the prize for?
Yeah, so what we looked into was something called abdominal aortic calcification, which is sort of a measure of calcified walls of the artery that runs sort of in the abdominal in front of the lumbar spine. So we've shown that previously that this is associated with all sorts of negative health outcomes relating to cardiovascular disease, cognition, musculoskeletal health. But one of the key limitations to actually using this in practice is how long it takes for AAC to actually be assessed from images. So what this paper did and what our team have developed is a machine learning algorithm to automatically score AAC from DEXA lateral spine images. And we showed that these automatic scores were associated with fall and fracture risk in a cohort of older Australian women living in the community. So I guess implications of this work is that we see that this algorithm could be incorporated into routine clinical practice. So for any woman that has a bone density test and has a lateral spine scan, we can automatically assess their AAC immediately and rapidly, and then that can provide really important prognostic information to their clinician and sort of identify those at the greatest risk.
And is that's a software program initially that you're using?
Yeah, so we developed the machine learning algorithm, or our computer science colleagues mm-hmm. we worked with, using images from a cohort that they then sort of developed and trained the algorithm that ultimately we see being sort of incorporated into DEXA software for clinicians to be able to use. But we've got the algorithm to use on cohort data at the moment.
I know all the radiographers listening will be shouting at the computer, ask them about the effect on DEXA scanning, because one of the things when, as a clinician, when we see a calcified aorta, it sort of ruins the quality of the DEXA scanning to some extent, because all that calcium absorbs radiation. And what happens is we do a DEXA expecting to find low bone density at the spine, and the result comes back showing quite good bone density, but we know it's not a proper result. Is there any way in which you could somehow extract from the DEXA result the fact that there's calcium in the aorta? Could you use your software to do that? Could you sort of clean up the DEXA for us?
Possibly. Yeah, it's a really good question, an important issue that we can speak to our computer science colleagues about, maybe applying the machine learning sort of approach to that problem.
You heard it here first, folks.
Research live on Bone Up. What are the challenges, do you think, about taking this technology now into clinical practice and applying it to a lot of people?
Yeah, so one of the key things that we're working on at the moment is verifying the performance of the algorithm in independent cohorts, so not the same cohort that it was sort of trained and tested on. And we're using the cohort in Manitoba with Professor Bill Leslie to verify that. And that sort of work is underway. So that's being presented here at ECTS and is... there's a paper under review at the moment, just recently accepted in JBMR, sort of verifying the algorithm works in an independent cohort, which is a really important step before it's then put into clinical practice.
It's really nice to see prize-winning research that really feels like it's going to impact patients' lives and quite quickly. It seems like a really wonderful use of AI in healthcare. It's a really good example.
You're impacting patients' lives in other ways, I think, because you've broader interests. Tell us a little about the prostate cancer work you've been doing as well.
Yeah, so my background's in exercise science, and my PhD was in men with prostate cancer. So we looked at men on androgen deprivation, so who have basically reduced testosterone. Yeah. So that comes with a whole range of side effects impacting musculoskeletal health. So they lose bone really quickly and muscle really quickly as well. So we looked at an exercise training intervention to try and offset that bone loss. So we randomized men to receive a 12-month exercise training program as well as protein, calcium and vitamin D supplementation, and compared that to usual care. And then we measured DEXA and PQCT outcomes over the course of that 12 months.
And does that exercise program start before the man starts the testosterone lowering treatment, or does it wait until after that's happened?
Yeah, so ideally, yes, they would start sort of as soon as possible with, obviously it's quite a niche population, so recruitment wise, practicalities, we sort of recruited people once they were on treatment predominantly. Yeah. But we tried to get them to do, I guess the exercise type is really important when it comes to bone health. So we had resistance training as well as what we call impact loading. So little hops and jumps to provide some stimulus to the bone. Because we know that sort of aerobic exercises aren't as effective for bone. That was sort of what we aimed to do. Unfortunately, the results sort of weren't as positive as we had hoped. And a large reason for that when we did per protocol analyses, looking at those who were adherent to the intervention, we saw better effects. So it just highlighted that, you know, an exercise program doesn't necessarily suit everyone.
Did you find that predominantly older men, obviously, with prostate cancer, did you find they were keen to exercise? Because people often come to me with osteoporosis and say, well, what can I do? Doc, you know, what food can I eat? What exercise can I do? Did you find them keen to participate?
Anecdotally, it was interesting to see some of the men, there was a real buy-in, and they loved coming into the gym. They trained together. They'd go for a coffee afterwards as well. They, you know, sort of checked up on each other if someone wasn't at a session. So there was a core group that really loved the gym environment and coming in to supervise sessions. But on the other hand, there were some that, you know, were barely adherent at all. So I think that's something that I'm really interested in now, is how can we tailor these interventions to each individual so that we can consider what they enjoy, what they're going to benefit from, and sort of try and meet in the middle a little bit. So some, we might not prescribe the perfect intervention for their bone health, but if they're going to actually stick to it and adhere to it, then that's better than...
Yeah, get the patient to help design their own exercise program.
Exactly.
My other thought then is, what about women with breast cancer also on aromatase inhibitors? There's a study for you. We're giving you lots of ideas.
No, exactly.
Today, aren't they? So there's
I've done qualitative work in men with prostate cancer and women with breast cancer, discussing sort of what exercise and diet support they receive and what they would want to receive. And that was one of the clear messages, was they want individualized supports that are tailored to their comorbid conditions, what they're interested in, just their life situations. So, you know, diet-wise, women with breast cancer often are cooking for their family, so they have to factor in what their kids enjoy eating. So it's just so many just things that we might not think about,
but it's what makes it interesting and engaging and rewarding seeing patients, isn't it? You know, because human beings are all different.
Exactly, yeah.
It's really impressive to see the depth and the breadth of your research. I'm really impressed. Thank you very much for coming and talking to us today. And listeners at home, I think Jack De La Vie is one to watch.
Yep. Thanks very much. Thanks for not mentioning the ashes as well.
Thanks for having me.
So we're delighted to have a friend of the podcast who has spoken to us a number of times in the past, Professor Kasim Javed from Oxford. I feel if we were a comedy quiz panel show, you would be one of the sort of team captains for Bone Up.
Would I be Ian Hislop or Paul Merton?
Well, that's a good question.
I think my hairstyle goes one way.
That's a good question. So thanks, Cas, for making the time to come and speak to us again. We're always excited to speak to you. And we will have a mug for you eventually. We were going to ask you about your takeaways from the Congress here, but just before that, we're both very excited, aren't we? Clinicians practicing in the UK about the news we've heard in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, it's really a culmination of well over two years' work by the Royal Osteoporosis Society to actually take the top-down approach for FLS. Fracture liaison services make clinical sense and they are cost effective. But we weren't just getting that traction with hospital managers because it wasn't mandated by the NHS. Mm-hmm. So through the all-party parliamentary group, over 200 MPs across the party said it was a good idea. First achievement. Second, Craig, really, the chief executive of the IRS, takes credit. He had the vision to push and push and push. Meeting with number 10, health policy advisors, the OBR, the Treasury, to what would it take to make sure no patient is left behind after fracture. Mm-hmm. Idea of a transformation fund, a national implementation group, using data to say the job is done, rather than just making the fund and letting people apply, but really working on the detail of phased approaches and the advantages of the new structure of the of England. We got so close with the major condition strategy till July the 4th happened. We were nervous. I was very nervous because that was a very strong Tory push, and they actually went on the record to say they would have funded an FLS mm-hmm. transformation fund. And the fantastic news is that Labour are at least going to match it. So whatever wow. happens on July the 4th, we've got it in writing. There will be a transformative approach to making sure no patient's left behind.
And so we can look forward to genuinely every patient in the UK, Scotland, England, Wales, Northern Ireland having an FLS?
Well, this is an NHS England transformation yeah. fund, but it will really leverage the other nations to do that, because the, Wales, we don't have to worry about. Inder Singh got £1 million for FLSs across Wales. Not as much as maybe he might need, but it's enough of a leverage to really yeah. move it forward. So that model where policymakers say it's too expensive to let people fracture again, but I realize the healthcare system needs a little bit of kickstart pilot funding just for the first 2 years to set it all up. And then once it's embedded, the local healthcare system take ownership of the process seems to be the way forward.
And we've got coverage in Northern Ireland and Scotland, so it's great to see you're catching up in England.
Yeah, we will catch up. But, you know, I think that's what we need. And then we can really move on to the complicated stuff. This is just now moving from osteoporosis experts, DEXA experts, to actually project management, implementation, behavior change. This is about implementation now, not science.
Yeah, isn't it great? You open a clinic, you treat 100 patients, you change government policy, you treat millions of people.
Spot on, and that's why I do this. That's why I do. I mean, there are over 500,000 patient records in the FLSDB. That's incredible.
It's sick. So, a really exciting congress as well. What going home from here? What are you going to remember in a week's time? What's going to change what you do in a week's time, let's say, or a month's time from what's gone on today?
Quite a lot. It's been really nice meeting. Very deep science, but also very clinically applicable. One thing is the artificial intelligence. Lots mm-hmm. of talk about it. We're running a study with the ADOPT study through NIHR. I'm being plugged a lot, which really gives me the motivation to, you know, really get those results out. But the other issue is around common diseases. So diabetes and bone health is not sorted. Mm-hmm. We don't know why diabetics have fractures. And the really concerning thing is the new, you know, transformative treatment for diabetes are really bad for bone.
Yeah.
I mean, they did a randomized controlled trial in people who didn't have diabetes but had fracture risk. And over 1 year, they lost 3%, almost 3% of the bone density at the hip. That's a lot. And if you have risk factors for osteoporosis, and then you add that on again, I mean, that is a concern. And we are not, we can take two approaches. We can be reactive, and we see the fracture data, do something about it. But I think the BMD data and the QCT data is enough. We need to be more proactive and say, actually, what are we doing about this? What are the studies we need to do now to see how do we mitigate that risk? Is it through lifestyle? Is it through muscle preservation? Is it through bone, or a combination?
But hasn't there always been a bit of a black hole in diabetes and osteoporosis where we treat diabetics with osteoporosis, not really knowing if the drugs work, or there's very little data there?
There is, and I don't know why that is. I mean, we've really been very passionate about aromatase inhibitors, steroid-induced osteoporosis. I think because diabetes is so complicated, because it doesn't match any of our models. They have low bone turnover, they have higher than you'd expect BMD, and they're fracturing. And it's kind of like, oh, that's really complicated. What are we going to do? Is it age-related glycosylation? Is it something more fundamental going on at the cellular level? Is it a matrix effect? It's sort of like, it's very complicated. But I think the new treatments, they're going to say, well, actually, we've removed the diabetes. Now deal with it is a golden opportunity, and I think it would be really important to prioritize that.
Look, thank you for taking the time to speak.
Not
to
at all.
It's super.
Well, you owe me the mug my bookshelf.
I owe you the mug. We will we'll get the photograph and we'll Photoshop the mug in. We should probably say the mugs were posted here a week ago and have not arrived, so that's part of the problem. But we will promise we'll get a mug to everyone we've spoken to at the podcast.
And Cass, I think you're going to be the only person to have every mug.
Yeah. I've been diligent with you guys.
I've been diligent.
I plugged you, and I have to listen to more of your podcasts. But I think it's really important because it's a new way we're going to communicate. And I'd love patients to listen to these as well.
Yeah. Right. We really appreciate your support and your friendship. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So we're delighted now to speak to some of the team from the IFMRS who are joining us today. And I'll ask you just to introduce yourselves and say a little about your role. And then we'll get into some of the interesting things the IFMRS are doing.
Hi, my name is Federico Moscagiuri. I'm the CEO of IFMRS.
Hi, my name is Ralph Müller. I'm the secretary of IMRS, and my interest in the International Federation of Muscle Excluded Research, so that's a very important part.
I'm glad you said that, Ralph.
Exactly. Yeah. Is also to, you know, bring people together, of course, and an alliance is really there with federation. We do that is something that we can really bring people together on board. And that's my interest to be as a secretary also to connecting to the society.
This is the umbrella body for bone research and bone health organizations around the world, is that?
It's really musculoskeletal, so we're really trying to include everything that is musculoskeletal to bring the musculoskeletal space forward and not be bone specific, although we certainly have origins. Many of the societies have bone origin, but we also have societies like the Orthopedic Research Society. We have societies that are dealing with rehabilitation, and it's really everything to do with that. But Federico can say more about these kinds of things.
And our third guest?
Yeah, my name is Aline Bozek, and I'm editor-in-chief of IFMRS Hubble, which is a platform for young investigators, and I'm here to promote young investigators and as well to promote the MSK field.
And Hubble is a platform for education and for young investigators across the world, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. That's why it's part of IFMRS as well.
Great.
Yeah, so as Ralph was saying, the IFMRS is a global alliance of musculoskeletal research societies, and our purpose is to advance musculoskeletal science through collaboration. We're here really to bring everyone together to help the whole global community work better together, to share knowledge, to join our voices in influencing at the global level, to change the fact that despite their huge impact, musculoskeletal conditions across the board are almost universally underprioritized, and therefore research is also underprioritized. So we feel that needs to change. We want to work together to influence at the WHO level to make that policy change. But we also want to support the whole community in terms of building a network of knowledge so that we're enabling conversations to happen, organizations and individuals can learn from each other, and also providing resources for individuals like the one that Aline is leading, which is a really useful, unique resource that is primarily aimed at young investigators, but also has a very wide appeal to a much broader range of researchers.
What kind of content do you host then on Hubble that will support young scientists and researchers?
So we host an interview, we host as well commentary, we host protocol if they have any specific protocol in MSK research or in clinical research, and we hope to host as well new podcasts and so on. Yeah.
Fantastic. What kind of opportunities do you think are there for the IFMRS to sort of change the game for musculoskeletal research?
Well, I mentioned the WHO, and we are seeing a shift happening slowly but surely to recognize the importance of dealing with the burden of MSK conditions. So I think on one hand, we have to make sure that our voice is heard within that wider agenda, that we can demonstrate why it's important to invest in MSK. In the sense that it's going to enable people to remain independent, pain-free, have a better quality of life, remain in work. These are the big things that policymakers are interested in. And so by joining forces and by having a really strong, clear message around that, I think we can start to shift the dial a little bit. And we are seeing more interest, as I said. But that's only at one level. Then there's much that we can do to support the global community, to upskill researchers in low and middle income countries, for example, where we're doing quite a lot of work, And so it's multi-layered, but ultimately it's up to all of us to pool our forces, pool our resources, and really get that combined influence going.
I was wondering, is it more about getting availability of drugs and all this wonderful research we see in low and middle income countries, or is it more about changing policy so that people are more aware and educated in lower and middle income countries?
Yeah, maybe I saw something to that. I think that's quite an important part. It's really about when you do that, so it's really important to empower people locally. Mm. And so we want to include them in our, you know, future young leaders, future leaders programs, so that they also participate also on the round. So it is something that the Federation has a system of a council, and so all our member societies, which also incorporate societies from low middle income countries, have a voice. And so it's very important that we unite all of these voices in one voice, right? And I think you're speaking, I think that's starting to reflect now more with the societies that they see, like they're trying, you know, each individual society that is a big society will try to influence even worldwide because they have international members. But it's very difficult, right? Because you're not an honest broker at that level anymore. But we can be that honest broker. We can be the one voice, it can come through us. We can be the contact person because we may be representing 20,000 individual researchers in the end, you know, so that's the dream, right? So have that one voice and be in these countries, but you have to be there, right? You cannot just invite them to be part. You really have to give them a voice. You have to give them equity and inclusion. It's a very important part, right? So that's what I see, and we still work more on that actually to have the people here.
Yes, and today we have 27 member societies from all over the world, including from Africa, Latin America. We're increasing our numbers all the time. We've also got 6 affiliate organizations that align with what we're trying to do. And we're building partnerships all the time, particularly with organizations that are not just working in bone, but in muscle, in rehabilitation, as Ralph mentioned. So we're really spreading out, and we're starting to really see, as you say, that critical mass. The other thing that we do is we provide resources, I think I mentioned, like the one that Aline is leading up. We also have the Knowledge Portal, which is a repository of genetic and genomic data. Yesterday we had a great session here at the ECTS Congress, which demonstrated a real good practical use of the portal in making links between mouse data and human data. So that's also a resource that we've built for the community, which we continue to build all the time. And we have a virtual library, which is also a place where people can go to find really useful resources from all our member societies.
Can I ask you, Helena, is Hubble responsive to what people want? Is it just you putting on it what you think people ought to hear? Or are you listening to people in different parts of the world asking for resources?
No, we are. It's a back and forth, as you said. So we are listening to people, what they need, and we are happy of receiving anything that they want. Of course, we have editorial board to check the quality and to check what we put on the platform, but everything is welcome. It's everything about MSK. Even people that want to promote themselves, you know, or that are looking for a job, everything that makes them prone to go in their future's career as well is very cool for Hubble.
So yeah, so it's a real platform for the bone and muscle world, is it? Yeah, that's great.
If you're a young scientist out there and you're interested in checking it out, IFMRS will put some links in the podcast. It seems like a one-shop musculoskeletal research shop. Thank you, everyone.
Absolutely.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
Welcome, listeners. Bone Up Live 2024, Marseille, and we're here with Annegret and Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you both have a role on the ECTS. Peter, would you tell us about what you do?
So until recently, I was a member of the ECTS Academy, which is a group of young researchers trying to further advance the field and empower young scientists in the ECTS. And I have also been the editor-in-chief of the newsletter, which is a monthly letter that every ECTS member receives. And I was also working on the Central Eastern Europe Action Group, trying to attract more people from these countries to the ECTS and to make ECTS more relevant to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was particularly interested to know what your priorities were with the sort of Central and Eastern European group. Do you feel there's a demand for more interest in bones in that part of the world?
Yeah, actually, this part of the world is not sufficiently represented in the ECTS, and the ECTS tries to take, to have, you know, entire Europe involved as much as possible. And also considering some special challenges in this part of Europe. I mean, there are challenges obviously everywhere, but some are, let's say, more pronounced in this area. Then ECTS was thinking how they can help the region to get more integrated. And
is the gap more in clinical services, or is the gap in research, do you see?
I think both. I think both in clinical services. There's also, I mean, there's treatment gap everywhere, but in some of those countries you don't have really the newest drugs that are available. Yeah. For example, in the Netherlands you have some that we don't have in Serbia. But there's also, I think, a gap in research. There's not so many people working in bone, and even if they do, maybe they're gravitating to some other societies, not the ECTS. And also there are issues, you know, with the finances and so on, and the ECTS came up with a reduced fee for people from those countries, and I think this really contributed to attracting more people.
And what do you do when you're not working for ECTS, then? Where do we find you on Monday morning?
Monday morning?
Yeah. Well, not this Monday, because you'll be here in Marseille, but where do we find you next Monday morning? What do you do?
Yeah, next Monday morning, I think this is the end of semester. I'm professor in human anatomy at Faculty of Medicine in Belgrade. And yeah, next Monday morning will be, I think, the end of semester and probably the start of examination period. So
you're on holiday next Monday. That's nice. Thank you.
Something like that.
And Annegret, what's your role in the ECTS?
Well, I have also been a member of the Academy, and I've even had the pleasure of chairing the Academy for 2 years, which was really a great experience. And I've been on the Scientific Program Committee, and I've been also on the Financial Committee. I think both are also very interesting roles I could have had in ECTS. Yeah.
And what about your research?
Well, my research focuses on bone marrow adiposity, which is basically the fat cells inside the bones. And we more and more think that they have an important role also in bone metabolism and in energy metabolism. And that is what I'm looking at, basically.
Excellent.
Thank you very much, both.
Thank you. That's great.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to say we have our next guest, Martha Blank. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
I saw you give your excellent talk today in the basic science session, and I thought I'd grab you and get you in to tell us about your research. But before we get started, which institute are you from?
I'm from the St. Vincent's Institute of Medical Research in Melbourne.
Oh, fantastic.
And that's not an Australian accent? Where are you from?
Absolutely an Australian accent.
It is an Australian accent. Okay, fair enough.
This is why they kicked me out of Austria.
Austria, okay. Well, you've brought the lovely weather with you anyway from Australia.
I tried. I packed everything into my luggage.
Big suitcase.
Big suitcase, yeah. Two, actually.
So can you tell us about the research that you presented in your excellent talk today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been starting actually my PhD with a mouse model which has a brittle bone phenotype, and that's the DMP1 Cre FMB2 mouse model. And in this mouse model we really showed that the bones are significantly weaker, so they break more easier, but there's no change in the amount of bone that's really could be the reason for this bone strength defect.
So where do you think the bone strength defect arises from?
Yeah, so we thought about this as well, and with some discussion with collaborators, so we really thought that the bone material quality was deteriorated, and we followed up with some measurements, and we looked at the mineral phase and the collagen phase, which are the two dominant parts in bone, and we found that we have both more mineral and more collagen in the bone, which makes them break easier.
So how can having more collagen and more mineral make the bones break easier? It actually sounds a bit counterintuitive.
Yeah, but you have to consider that just because we have more doesn't mean that the geometry of the bone is actually altered. So the geometry was the same, but it's just a more dense and compact material. And the more mineral, it's like with a dry stick, you can break it really easy because you don't have the flexibility anymore of the collagen to prevent the fractures.
This is something we've come across before, speaking to other researchers. We've talked a little about the effect of diabetes in bone and how often I see patients with what look like typical osteoporotic fractures, but you measure their DEXA scan and their bone density looks quite good. Often those are patients who have diabetes. And we then wonder, the drugs that we use that are sort of based on the premise that we're giving people more bone, how do we know they work on people who fracture despite the fact their bone is already quite dense? So presumably your work will give us some insights into that.
Yes, so it's also quite interesting if you think already, if you treat someone, I don't know, who's prevalent maybe to have osteoporosis and to have a fracture, mm-hmm. if you are really inhibiting the cells that are eating away the bone, which is what you want because you want more bone to form, but that also means that the bone is not turned over as much, so you will get more bone material, which is older, and which is also probably more prevalent to break, actually, yeah.
And why will that older tissue be more prevalent to breakage? What happens to the tissue as it becomes older?
Yes, so we do know from like very much the first phase how mineral crystals nucleate in the collagen matrix, and that's very well clear defined. But the maturation afterwards, which is really the really long phase, mm-hmm. We don't really 100% know how the two phases change during this this period.
Yeah, we don't want to send out the message that bisphosphonates don't work if you have diabetes. That's important. But there was, I noticed, a presentation this morning, someone looking at giving anabolic agents to people with diabetes, and that seemed to be actually to work better in an interesting way. So I think that's a big area of growth that we need to look at, how to treat people who have better bone density, lots of bone, but the quality is just not as good.
Yes, absolutely. But the limiting factor is just that we would need biopsies, and that's just, can't really take out the bone and give it to us, unfortunately, to look at.
Before we started, you were talking a little about osteocytes, and that's something's come up a few times here. Most people, well, I hope most people know about osteoblasts and osteoclasts, because I spend my life explaining about them to people. The third cell that people don't know as much about is the osteocyte. And you've done some work on how the osteocyte can sense how dense the bone is around it. Is that right?
Maybe not 100% sensing, but we think that the osteocytes, which are terminally differentiated, and they are actually the main cell population in the bone, right?
In the bone,
So they must be very important. So they sense changes in their environment, because they have an extensive network which basically almost covers all of the centimeters in there, which is quite fascinating. And we think that they are able to respond to this maturity effect of collagen and mineral as well.
Any ideas about how they might sense the density around them?
This is probably really just with fluid that they have in their canal. So when you compress, they sense the mechanical stimulus, and that might change as well. And that will be very interesting to see in those fractures who do not have any change in bone mass, whether they have a different fluid stress.
Wouldn't it be great if we had some measure of how osteocytes work then? So when I saw that patient who seemed to have normal bone density but was having fractures, maybe there's some problem with the osteocyte function?
Yes. Absolutely, that would be fantastic.
Osteocytes almost struck me as like the dark matter of osteoporosis, that everyone knows they're there, but our understanding of how they work is really very limited as compared to the other cells.
I think it's also because they're not the active part of resorption and bone formation, mm-hmm. that they have been a little bit left out, and people have been focusing on just bone formation and bone resorption. But I definitely agree with that osteocytes play an incredible amount part of in this scenario.
A new frontier in bone research, listeners. You heard it here first. Thank you very much, Martha.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time and bringing the lovely weather.
Oh, always.
For the benefit of the tape, we're standing on the roof of the conference venue in the beautiful sunshine, listening to foghorns and car sirens. Listeners, the conference is over now and it's nearly time to leave sunny Marseille and go back home again. We hope you've enjoyed the conference as much as we have, and we hope you've learned as much as we have.
I've certainly learned lots. Richie, we learned that neither you nor I are particularly gifted at Patank, but apart from that, we did get lots of new insights into various aspects of bone health and bone disease, and in fact a few new things that I'm quite excited, to go back to my clinic and talk to patients about and see if it can make a difference to what I do every day. And the other good news, I think, is we've heard that not just these episodes, but our archive of episodes on Bone Up will soon appear on the online learning environment called Hubble, which is facilitated by the IFMRS, the International Federation for Musculoskeletal Research. So we're very appreciative to Federico and his colleagues for facilitating that. And we hope that our archive, you know, can be of use to more people around the world. So thanks for listening, and we hope to see you again soon.
Bye, everyone.
Au revoir, tout le monde.